All right, one last time, this is our outline of the book of John. Three major sections as per the outline from Baxter. And we are in that final section, and we're talking here about the resurrection and his appearance. And as many have labeled chapter 21, Baxter does as well, as an epilogue. Why is that the case? We'll come to that in chapter 21. All right, let's review where we have been in our chapters one last time. And let's see what we've got. Chapter 1 was, he's the true light. Chapter 2, the power and authority of Christ. Chapter 3, Nicodemus said he is a teacher come from God. Chapter 4, this message spread, yeah, to the Samaritans and the Galileans. Because he's called in question of who he is, he calls for witnesses to his evidence of his deity. Chapter 6 made a claim. He is the bread of life. Chapter 7. Yeah, very good. Chapter 8. Yeah, reminds us of, if you missed this one, I've mentioned it several times. That chapter reminds us of, very good. Who said that? Bingo. You get the smiley face. All right. Chapter 9. All right, the man was healed of his blindness, but the Pharisees were blinded. Chapter 10, we have another claim. He is, yes, good shepherd. Chapter 11, resurrection and life. Now, chapter 12 starts something new. What happens in chapter 12? Last trip to Jerusalem. This is the beginning of Paschal week, as we call it. Chapter 13. All right, he washes the disciples' feet. That's that section wherein the disciples have a discussion, or Jesus has a discussion with the disciples. Chapter 14, he comforts the disciples. Chapter 15, their relationships. 16, his final discussion with the disciples. And then chapter 17 is where he prays. Chapter 18. Yeah, this is at the last week of the life of Christ. All of this since chapter 12 is that last week. Chapter 19, he was crucified and we left him in the grave last week, and we're waiting to see the resurrection in chapter 20. All right, just as a footnote and a reminder for those in this class and those who listen online, we have a number of people listening online. If you want a copy of these slides, you need to email me. You can email me through the church's website or email me directly and ask to be added to the list. Don't just email me, but ask to be added to the list, and you will get a few minutes or an hour or so before class, you will have all the slides. If you're not a part of that, not getting that, you need to email me and tell me what you want, and you'll be added to that list. All right, chapter 20 is about what? The resurrection. You want a summary of that? Verse 6, 7, and 8. Here Simon Peter came and others came and they looked into the tomb, and what did they find? The tomb was empty. And they found the empty tomb, therefore Jesus was raised from the dead. All right, this is the last time we're seeing this calendar for a while, because we've worked through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and this is John. And we won't be on this calendar for a little while, unless we talk about something in a sermon. But anyway, be that as it may, we are now on this last Sunday. Chapter 12 started us on Sunday, and then we jumped over to Thursday, because John doesn't deal with that Tuesday conflict like Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so we jumped to Thursday and Friday, and Saturday is the day in the tomb, and now this is the day of the resurrection a week later from his triumphal entry. Make sense? All right. So let's talk about what chapter 20 is about. Three things are developed here in chapter 20. The tomb was found empty. Jesus appears to the disciples. And then John talks about why he writes. Now, if we took chapter 21, and I'll say more about this later, and just cut it off from the book of John, it sounds like the book is done and finished, doesn't it? There's a reason for that, and we'll talk about that here in just a moment. So that basically is the ending of the book. It does seem like we have an addendum here in chapter 21. But let's talk about the tomb being found empty. So we have some ground to cover. Let's get question number three. Make sure I've got the right set of questions. I think I do. Yeah. Chapter, question number 3. List the appearances of Jesus in John 20. He appeared to Mary Magdalene, verses 11 to 18, to 10 disciples, 19 to 23, and then to, yeah, 11, because why not 12? Judas is gone. And so the 11 apostles, 24 to 29. All right. Let's see if I want to cover anything else. Let's go and get question 5. What was the purpose of John's writing? All right. That they might believe, and that believing they may have life in the Son of God. All right. Here's what happens in verses 1 to 10. The tomb was found empty. The empty tomb, I am convinced, is the strongest argument that can be made for the resurrection of Christ. Are there other arguments? Conversion of Saul, the transformation of the disciples, the manuscript evidence, on and on we could list the evidences of the resurrection. But if I could speak to the world, if someone bought time and said, you can speak to the entire world about the resurrection and you can only make one argument, what would I say? I'd talk about the empty tomb. It's the strongest argument. And this is an argument made here in John chapter 20. The tomb is empty. How did it become empty? And so we're going to see some evidence of that as we go along. Verse 1a says that this was on the first day of the week. Matthew makes a distinction between the Sabbath and the first day. And so this is not on the Sabbath. This was on the first day of the week. So as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early. It was still dark. Now, verse 1b and verse 2, what she found was stone had been rolled away. And she ran, and she knew that the body was not there. She saw enough to know the tomb was empty because she ran and told Peter, he's not there. In other words, she's saying the tomb is empty. We'll come back to that. Were there others there with her? John's account alone doesn't reflect that. Mark 16 and Luke 24 tell us that others went with her. She was not by herself when she came. So who was with her? Well, there was the mother of James, there was Salome, and there was Joanna. Joanna's mentioned in Luke 24. The others are mentioned over in Mark 16. So those were with her, not mentioned here. The focal point is what Mary did, and Mary went telling others about that. What an incredible woman she must have been. So let's start at verse 3 now. Peter and John found the tomb empty. There's some profound information here. Let's start at verse 3. Peter therefore went out, and the other disciple, who's that other disciple? Most likely John. He describes himself in the book, and we're going to see something about that in chapter 21 as the disciple that Jesus loved. There was a special relationship there. We mentioned last week there's that inner circle, Peter, James, and John, and seemingly John had a closer relationship to the Lord than the others, but be that as it may. That Peter therefore went out and the other disciple, and they both ran together, but the other disciple outran Peter and came first to the tomb. What did he do when he got there? He looked in but didn't go in. He wasn't bold enough to, I'm not suggesting we need to criticize his boldness, but he's not quite as bold as Peter. It's interesting that he looks in but doesn't barge in. But when Peter arrives, not surprisingly, he barges right in. That's just like Peter. But Peter's going to change, as we're going to see in chapter 21 here in a moment. But they look in, they saw the linen cloth lying there. Verse 5, and Peter went in and saw the linen cloth lying there. That is, the cloth that was wound around the body that prepared it for burial, it's still lying there. There's something to be said about that. Before we make that point, let's look at verse 7. What else did they see? Face cloth. It was folded together in a place by itself. Seemingly, that word can be translated and is by some rolled. Maybe it was rolled up and laid together, or it might have been literally folded and placed by itself, which suggests there was not haste in leaving. The charge was by the soldiers, disciples have stole it. Now, if you're going to steal a body, do you take time to take the linen cloth off and take the face cloth and then fold it together or roll it up tightly and place it in a place by itself? That suggests there was not haste in leaving. So the disciples didn't steal the body. The enemies didn't steal the body. They had no motive for stealing the body. Proof for them would be for the body to still be there, so that when someone claims he was raised from the dead like he said he would be, no, he wasn't. There he is. His body's still there. He's dead. So one didn't have a motive. The other had no opportunity, and they would not have left it in the situation that they left it in. And then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in, and he saw, and the result was he believed. The tomb is empty. They know it hasn't been stolen. He indeed has been raised from the dead. That's the strongest argument can be made for the resurrection. Now let's look at verse 9. They didn't yet understand or know the prophecy. What's that about? Yes. Yeah. Good point. Even being convinced that he's raised from the dead, they're not connecting the dots, even though Jesus had told them this fulfilled prophecy. So what prophecy are we talking about? Most likely Psalm 16:10. Was that the only prophecy? No. That's quoted, by the way, in Acts 2. And the resurrection was said to be a fulfillment of that. But furthermore, Isaiah 53:10 would be another prophecy. Those are two. I'm convinced Genesis 3:15 is another prophecy, the first one of that. Did I see a hand up? I thought I saw a hand go up back here a minute ago. Is that making sense to you? So they're not connecting the dots that this is the prophecy and this is prophecy being fulfilled. Now verse 10, they went to their own homes. That's caused some question among commentators that the disciples then who came to the tomb. Now, Mary doesn't leave just yet because she's going to hang around there. And I think this seems to be chronological in chapter 20. But nonetheless, she's run and told others. Here comes Peter and John. And they come, and there's these other women there. And they all go back to their home. Mary doesn't seem to, Magdalene. And so why do they go to their own home? Well, some have suggested, and possibly all of these could be true, that they didn't know what else to do. They're waiting for more instructions. If the Lord's been raised, we're waiting. What do we do now? We don't know. We don't know what we do yet. Mark 16 seems to indicate fear was the biggest issue. So let's go over to Mark 16 and in verse 19 just a quick reference. That the guards had been placed around this. They knew the hatred for Jesus. So notice in Mark 16 and in verse 8, they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, and they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Connect that with verse 19. When the disciples that same day assembled, the doors were secured. Why? Fear of the Jews. So why did they go to their own home? Well, they may not have known what to do. What else do we do? We don't know what to do. We're waiting for more evidence, more instruction. We don't know. But probably because they're afraid seems to be the biggest drive. Let's just go home. We don't know what to do. This is perplexing. The tomb is empty. We don't know. Make sense to you? All right. So the tomb is empty. Mary Magdalene was there, found it, and Peter and John go and find it. Now he appears to his disciples. First to Mary Magdalene, we're coming back to that, then to the 10, and then to all of the apostles, including Thomas. So there's the appearances that we want to talk about. So first of all, to Mary Magdalene, what do we know about what took place here? What is she doing at verse 11? She's standing outside the tomb. She's weeping. And she stooped down and looked into the tomb. Apparently, she knew the tomb was empty to start with. Whether she had looked, how closely she had looked earlier, she's looking now and stooping and looking in. And what does she hear or see? Two angels. Where are they? They're in the tomb, but there's more information. where Jesus had laid, one at the head and the other at the foot. And what do they say? Yeah, who are you seeking? In other words, who are you looking for? Why are you weeping, number one? The other text, parallel accounts, give us a little more information about that. We're not going to take the time to trace. But why are you seeking the living among the dead? The dead are supposed to be here. He's alive. It's an announcement of the resurrection. But so why are you weeping? Well, they've taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they've laid him. And so, trying to follow our outline here, she's out there weeping. The angel said, why are you weeping? And they've taken my Lord away. Somebody's done that. Now then, Jesus appears to her, and he says to her, yeah, why are you weeping, and who are you looking for? Who are you seeking? She thinks he may be gardener, and said, sir, if you've carried him away, where did you lay him, and I'll take him away. Now, why did she not recognize him? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, some commentators talk about she's weeping, she's blurry-eyed. Number one is she wasn't expecting to see him. Have you ever run into somebody that you know and you know well and you easily recognize once you got focused on them, but you were not expecting to see them in that place? It might even be a near relative, and you run into them somewhere where you're not expecting to see them, and you turn around and it takes you a moment to recognize that's them. That's possible. But it's also possible the last time she had seen Jesus, he's bruised and bleeding. And while he hasn't changed, the body hasn't changed, we're going to see that at verse 19 in a moment. That's yet to take place. There is some healing process that has taken place. He doesn't look like that bruised, bleeding person that she saw hanging on the cross. And she turns around and she sees Jesus and doesn't recognize him. And he says to her, something about the way he said that. She turns and refers to him as Rabboni. There is a word that means teacher, and one that means my great teacher. This word means my great teacher. There were many rabbis. This is my great rabbi. You are my great teacher. She recognized who he is when he turned and said, Mary. Now, verse 17, he said, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. And go tell the brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and to your Father and to my God and to your God. What's that about? All right. There is urgency. Don't cling to me. Don't stay close by. Don't stay here. Go spread this message. So there is that urgency of spreading the message. Some have suggested this idea of clinging to me, and some think that it means and probably implies you don't have to stay here and look and touch to realize this is me. My body has not yet changed. I've not yet gone to the Father. When he ascends to the Father, his body has changed, as yours will be when you are ushered into heaven. And so the point is, I think, that you can tell by looking without touching. You don't have to do that to know for sure this is me. You can look and you can see, and now get on with the message. Go tell others the message about the resurrected Lord. And so what does she do? Verse 18. Yeah, she takes off and she came and told the disciples she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. Did they accept that message? Mark 16:11 says not at first. They did, but not at first. They didn't understand it, that she's confused about this. So flag Mark 16 and in verse 11 as your parallel account to that. All right. So he appeared to Mary Magdalene. She's convinced it's him. She runs and tells others. Now that very same day that he was raised from the dead, that same day we had on the calendar a moment ago, he was raised that early morning. He's appeared to Mary Magdalene. The disciples have come and looked, and they've gone back to their home. He appears to the disciples as they are gathered. So a little bit later on, the time is not told, they gather together in a certain place. And verse 19 says, they've assembled together, the doors being secured for the fear of the Jews, and Jesus came and stood in their midst. I take that to be a miraculous entry. The doors are secured. No indication he knocks on the door and they admit him in, but he's suddenly in their midst. That's a miraculous entry. Now let me stop and footnote. We're going to talk about a number of miracles that are recorded here. We don't count the number of implications of miracles. See the difference? That's an implication of a miracle. It's not just stopped. There's no description of describing, here was the miracle that took place and the disciples were amazed. It is said that he was suddenly there. That's an implication of a miracle. I think there are a number of miracles, more than the number of seven or eight or nine, depending on how you count them. And we'll talk about the discrepancy in those numbers in chapter, at the end of this chapter. Make sense? So he says to them, peace be with you. Now there's a significance of mentioning that. He is pronouncing peace upon them while they are disturbed, but then there's something about this message of peace that they need to carry forth. And we're going to get to that here in a second. So let's look at verse 20. He showed them, what does that do? Proof of the resurrection. Here's evidence. Here's proof of the resurrection. I have been raised. I am the one that was crucified. Look at my hands. Look at my side. Look at my feet. I have been crucified. I am the same one. I don't just look like your Jesus. I am Jesus of Nazareth. I have been raised from the dead. And they were glad when they saw him. So now then, verse 21, 22, and 23. I put here on the outline, Jesus sends his disciples forth. This is what we don't often think about this, but this is actually a record of the Great Commission. We recognize Matthew and Mark as recording the Great Commission, and we also recognize, though people don't talk a lot about, Luke's account of the Great Commission, that the gospel was to be preached in Jerusalem, beginning first at Jerusalem, that repentance and remission of sins should be preached beginning in Jerusalem, Luke 24. This is John's account of that. The same day that he was raised from the dead, he commissions the disciples. This is parallel to Matthew 28, Luke 24, Mark 16. Now, he says, peace to you. He said that again. And as the Father sent me, I send you. I'm sending you out. That is a commission. Now, he's sending them out bearing the message of peace. This is the gospel of peace, Acts 10 and verse 34 and 38. And then when he said that, he breathed on them and told them to receive the Holy Spirit. Now, what's the connection between breathing and them receiving the Holy Spirit? Say again. All right, symbolic of new life. I want to come back to that. Yes. The word inspiration, 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is given by inspiration. And that means God breathed. So the words are given by the breath of God. Now, Jeff, again, what'd you say? Yeah, which produces life and the peace. Does that make sense? So verse 21, I'm only going to get this concept, verse 22. That is an affirmation of the inspiration that he had talked about in John 14 and John 15 and John 16. Those three chapters, remember those? This is that inspiration. You will be inspired as you go forth. Now with that in mind, he says at verse 23, if you forgive sins, they are forgiven. And if you retain sins, they are retained. In other words, if you tell someone their sins are forgiven, they're going to be forgiven. Well, that's not an arbitrary thing where you go out and tell anybody that you want, you just pick somebody and they're the worst sinner of all and they're not repenting and you say forgiven, I'll forgive them. That's not what he's saying. Whatever you preach by the breath that I gave you, whatever you preach by inspiration, when you pronounce forgiveness, they'll be forgiven. And when you say they're not forgiven and they're condemned, they'll be condemned. Does that make sense? It's an affirmation of inspiration of their message. This is the Great Commission that he sent forth. Now, what happens next in beginning at verse 24? 8 days later, which means it is the next Sunday. A week later, as the Jews would count the time, that would make that come up on the next Lord's Day. The disciples are assembled again. This time, somebody's there that wasn't there before. We call him Why? He didn't believe this message when they said, we saw the Lord, we were with him the day he was raised from the dead, and he came in our midst, and we saw his wounds, and he didn't believe. So what happens here, verse 25 to 29? We're more familiar with that, so I'm going to quickly go over that. And so he did. And Jesus said, reach forth your finger and put into my hand and put your hand into my side. Be not faithless, but believing. And what was his response? My Lord and my God. And then Jesus gives the assurance. You saw, and I'm going to paraphrase verse 29. You saw this evidence and you believe. Blessed are those who didn't see that evidence, but based on the testimony of those who did, that's me, that's you. And yet they still believe. Make sense? All right, let's quickly get to this last section, 20, 30 and 31. This is why John is writing. Verse 30, he said, many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. This was never intended to be a complete account. God's accounts often are incomplete on purpose. I'm sometimes amazed. You preach, say, a sermon on baptism, and I mention five verses. Somebody will say, you know, you didn't mention Acts 22. No, and I didn't mention 1 Peter. There's a whole bunch of left out. Well, the Lord does the same thing. You know, he didn't mention this miracle. He didn't intend to. It wasn't needed to make his point. Why was this written? So that they would have faith, and that having faith, they might have eternal life. Here's a practical thing I learned. The written word produces faith. The written word produces faith. Now, there are eight miracles. Some say seven. Some say nine. Notice that the resurrection is not included in this. That's the ultimate miracle. Depending on, so if you read a scholar and he says, well, there are seven miracles, and others are saying they're not counting the 21 because they think that's an addendum to the book, not included in the book itself. So whether they're including the resurrection, whether they're including chapter 21, I think there were eight miracles recorded here. There are others that are implied, like that miraculous appearance. So it's not an exhaust. There are 38 miracles, I think, recorded in the Gospels, and only eight of them. So 30 of them were left out, approximately. Now, we've talked about this in our first lesson. John is a climaxing book, starting with water to wine. You come to the raising of Lazarus. That's a greater miracle than turning water to wine, but his own resurrection is much greater than any of those. It's a climaxing book, and we just saw the greatest miracle of all. Making sense to you? All right, let's go to chapter 21. I may come back to this if time permits. Chapter 21, Jesus appears to his disciples. Many think that chapter 20 just ended the book, and this is an addendum. One of the better explanations of that is that chapter 21 is just as inspired as chapter 20 and 1 to 20, and that John may have, after he finished the book, decided that he would add some other information by inspiration that had not been recorded anywhere else. For example, this breakfast by the sea. Is that possible? Sure, that's possible. God may have told him to do that or led him to do that, but that he decided to add an addendum to a book that he just closed out. Have you ever written a letter and you got to add a P.S.? Here's something that gives a little more explanation. This is the P.S. right here. We have in chapter 21. He appears to his disciples. So we're going to have to quickly work through this. He's with the disciples at the sea. It's called the Sea of Tiberias. This is the Sea of Galilee right here. And right here, if you can see that arrow in the middle of that, there is the city of Tiberias right on the sea. It's called the Sea of Gennesaret, Luke 5, called the Sea of Galilee, many places. Sometimes it's referred to as the Sea of Tiberias. Same sea, the Sea of Galilee. That's a modern look of the Sea of Tiberias. All right, there are seven disciples that are mentioned. I'm not going to mention them all. You can read that for yourself at verse 2. And Peter, being the leader, said, let's go fishing. I'm going fishing, and they all go with him. And how many did they catch? None. Hadn't caught a thing. This is very similar to Luke was waiting for you to give me the chapter. This is very similar to an occasion when he called the disciples, which is recorded where there was at the sea a great catch of fish, miraculous catch of fish, Luke 5. All right, might flag that here at Luke 21. By that I mean make a marginal note. It's very similar to that. Perhaps that's being included, this is included here, or that story is added at the end of the ministry to remind them of the same kind of thing when they were called to the ministry. There's great similarity. All right, they're out fishing, they caught nothing. Jesus appears to them. He's standing on the bank and he asks them if they had any food, and they said they had none because they hadn't caught anything. And then he tells them, cast out on the right side. And how many fish did they catch? Huge number. Verse 11 says there was 153, but the net didn't break. Now, in Luke 5, they caught so many that they filled two boats and both boats began to sink. No indication of the boat sinking here. But they've caught nothing, meaning they've worked. These are men who are professional fishermen. They know how to fish. And they've caught nothing, and yet he said, cast down on the right side and you'll catch some. That was a miraculous catch of fish. And so they bring them in. Peter, when John tells him, it's the Lord over there on the bank. That's who that is. What'd Peter do? Jumped in the water. Why'd he do that? Yeah, he had cast off the outer garment and had only his undergarment, but the King James says he was, proper use of a term that you probably don't go around saying a lot, he was naked. Naked can mean a lack of clothing, doesn't always mean nudity. And he felt he was inadequate to see the Lord, and he jumped into the sea, the text says. Now, let's see what else happens. They were about, the other boat was about 300 feet from the shore, according to verse 8. Now then at verse 11, when they drag the net to the shore, Jesus tells them to come and eat breakfast, break their fast. And there was fire, there was bread, there was fish. Now, verse 14 said that was the third time he showed himself to his disciples. Now, that was not the third appearance. That was the third time he showed himself to the disciples. One was with the 10, the day he was raised. We saw that in chapter 20. The second was to the 11, 8 days later, and this is the third. You said, well, there are other appearances. Sure, there are other appearances. This is the third time he showed himself to the entirety of the group of disciples. All right. Now, let's... So they have breakfast by the sea. That gets us through verse 14. So again, here's evidence he's been raised from the dead. He just performed a miracle for them and brings them in. And they said, now the text doesn't say Jesus ate with them. I want to think that's implied, though I can't tell you that. I'm just telling you my conclusion, which would be further evidence that he was raised from the dead. A spirit doesn't eat. And so he... Did he partake? The text doesn't tell me that, so I can't tell you that, but I want to think he probably did, but I'll leave that for you to decide. Let's talk about Peter being restored. Now, we've got to work through this as quickly as we can. This seems to be where the Lord, I hadn't thought about this till recently read from a writer who said, had this not accomplished, Peter may have gone through the rest of his life wondering and worrying about the denying the Lord, and this is a statement by the Lord in essence saying, you are forgiven and you will be of use among my brethren. And maybe so. It does seem to be a case of his being restored. The first question is about love. He comes to Jesus, or Jesus comes to Peter and said, do you love me? And Peter's response is, yes. He asks him again, do you love me more than these? And I think these has reference to the other disciples. He had made that claim earlier that I'll die for you. They may betray you, but I'll die for you. And his answer the second time was, yes. And the third time, his answer was, yes. There's a second thing that's being accomplished here. And I think Peter is learning to be cautious, and the Lord is teaching him to be cautious. Peter had not been cautious up to this point. Now, in our English, we have love and love, but they're different words. Jesus said, do you agape me? That's the highest form of love. And Peter learned to be cautious because he'd spoken out boldly just a few days before, and he got caught on that and was embarrassed by that. And so he said, I phileo you. That's a warm, friendly love. I don't think he's saying I don't really have good love for you. I think he was cautious about being so bold. So he asked him again, do you agape me? And he said, I phileo you. And then Jesus turns and uses his word, do you phileo me? And he said, I phileo you. And his response was, therefore, I want you to feed my sheep. Now, Peter's faith, let's quickly talk about this. He says, you're going to live to be an old age, verse 18. You're going to be in prison, verse 18. You're going to die in service. But in the meantime, what you need to do is follow me. Kind of disturbed Peter. Because what did Peter do now? He turned to the man that Jesus loved and said, what about him? And Jesus' response was, if I say that he lives till I come, what is that to you? I told you to follow me, so you do that. Well, people misunderstood and misquoted the Lord, as is often the case. So we see Peter's love, Peter's faith, Peter's focus needs to be on Peter, not on everybody else. The Lord's trying to get Peter in line. I preached a sermon on Peter one time, and Sister, many of you don't remember her because she's been gone for a while. Sister Jessie Allen came out at the door and said, you know, once the Lord got him settled down, he turned out all right. I like the way she described that. The Lord took a while to settle him down. And once he got settled down, he turned out all right. All right. And then finally his conclusion here is that I am an eyewitness to this. The man who wrote this, I was an eyewitness. And I saw all of these things. But if I were to write everything, what would he say about that? The world couldn't contain the books. That's the gospel of John. That's it. Our time's gone. A few practical things on the screen if you want to take a look at those quickly. Chapter 1, we'll do an introduction. And chapter 1 next time of the book of Acts.